I hope your solo time was good. We're going to have our last session here and bring a good bit of conclusion to things we've talked about. I want to just address one thing, however, that may have come up in your solo time. And that's this question: what if none of these work? It's a great question, and it's a possibility. Proverbs is generally true as far as the principles in the book, but people often respond to even the most godly influences with bad choices. So what if I do that, Todd, and it doesn't work? And I suspect there may be some older folks here that's happened to you. You were a good parent, and your kid didn't respond well. Maybe a story would help you here. It helps me, because I've got things that I really thought I did well, and they just didn't turn out that way. It's like, wow. You know, and if I'm doing them for that reason, then I've got a gospel-centered issue, because we have to ask ourselves, is God a tool or a treasure? That's really when you do what's right, and God's not asking for us not to be involved in the situation, the process, but when things don't work out like you thought, do you abandon God and say, well, the leverage didn't work. I cranked on this with the God card, and it didn't work. So you know what? I'm done. Is he a tool or a treasure? And this story might help you. I think Spurgeon told this for years. I heard it from Keller. And it's very convicting. But it's somewhat of a made-up story. It's a parable, modern-day parable, about a king. And this farmer that kind of stewarded some land for him. One day he just produced this awesome carrot. This farmer just had this incredibly big carrot. It grew, and he just couldn't believe that a carrot this large would grow on his property. He said, I just want to take this to the king. So he hauls in this massive carrot to the king, and the king, being all-knowing and all-wise, understanding his motives, he said, thanks for the carrot. And so the farmer said, I just wanted to tell you I love you, and I appreciate you. Thanks for letting me grow land for you, grow crops for you. He turned to walk away, and the king said, wait a second, you know what? I own that land kind of right next to you. Why don't you just take some more 5 acres and grow some more carrots? You do so well with it. You're a good steward. The farmer said, really? Thanks. Well, in the courtyard, there was a herdsman, a rancher who heard. And he thought, wow, a carrot gets you 5 more acres? So he goes home, and he gets his finest horse. He shines it and brushes it and polishes it, whatever you do to horses. He brings it in. He trots this baby in. And he says, oh, king, just because I love you so much and I'm so glad you let me raise horses for you on this land where my stables are, I just wanted to bring you the finest horse I have. The king says, thanks. I appreciate it. And the rancher's kind of like waiting, and the king looks at him. He says, well, okay. And so he turns to walk away, and he's waiting for the king to stop him too and say, before you leave, but he never does. And he gets to the door and he stops and he turns to the king. He says, is there anything else you want to say? And the king says, are you looking for something more? He says, well, I was just curious about the man that brought the carrot and got the land. He said, oh, he gave me the carrot. You gave yourself the horse. It's pretty convicting, isn't it? God is often used as a tool to get our way, isn't he? And when we don't get our way just like we thought, then the best conversation is the one you have in the mirror when you say, wow, is God a tool or a treasure? And will I abandon my faithfulness to him just because suddenly maybe it didn't go like I thought? So I'm by no means standing up here saying, hey, these 7 things are a guarantee for perfect success. They may not. You may have folks respond to you in negative ways and take courses that are difficult and hard to understand. But if you'll factor faithfully for God's glory, if you'll model Jesus, because that's the heart of the gospel, that's what Jesus calls us to do, even in difficult times, then when God smiles upon you and this life is over, which really this is not the end of our reward, amen. Hebrews 11 says that those who went before us are waiting for us to get there, and we'll all share together. When that day occurs and the smile of God is placed upon our life, he approves, then really that's what we're waiting on, we're looking for. And it may be that you'll have to, and I'll have to, endure some very difficult things in this life, even while we factor well and faithfully. Is that okay to say?
Yeah.
I don't want you leaving here thinking, man, is this like some recipe for success with no failure? People can sometimes respond very negatively to the best mentors and models. But that doesn't give you room to quit. Jesus didn't quit, even though Judas responded evilly. I hope that helps a little bit, because we could leave here thinking, man, I better buckle down and tighten up, and all of us could do better, couldn't we? Let's just be honest, right? All of us could do better. And that's a treadmill. If you get on, you will wear yourself out, because you're never going to be good enough. You ever thought about that? You'll never be good enough. So at what point does a treadmill get so fast you can't keep up? Instead, just trust Jesus. Factor faithfully. Do your part. Trust Him. And keep Him in the crosshairs. Bring glory to His name. I mean, people that respond tough, let's keep being men. Let's have hard conversations. Let's lead well. But let's not hold God hostage in some corner. You didn't keep your word, and so I'm done with you. That comes back to haunt us in the end. Let's finish up this chapter with just one more bit of insight in regards to what he says about children, okay? I really struggle with, do I talk about the first part of verse 3 or the last part of verse 3? You know, the first part of verse 3 in Psalm 128 talks about a fruitful vine within your house. How many of you have gone to your wife and said, honey, you are a fruitful vine? I mean, that just doesn't happen, does it? I mean, you ever told your wife, you remind me of a cucumber plant? I mean, that's just not a good idea, okay? But the point here is that it's a very nourishing, supported, connecting type of plant that runs all through the house, and you couldn't have a home that works without a woman who's a fruitful vine. I won't go into that message. I will say this, there are no vines that are supported on their own. Every vine has something on which to lean and stand. So there's some real deliberateness in this idea of a fruitful vine. But I think the Lord would have us focus more on the last part of verse 4 when it says that our children will be like olive shoots around our table. You may have never said to your wife, wow, honey, you remind me of a cucumber plant or a watermelon vine. And you probably never said to your kids, you know what, son, daughter, you remind me of an olive shoot. We just don't use that kind of language. But here the scriptures say, your children will be like olive shoots around your table. That's an odd metaphor. It's an odd analogy, isn't it? We'd rather have the one in Psalm 127. Look up in this chapter. Verse 4. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior. Now, that's our analogy. That we like that. Talk about arrows. Yeah. We can tell our kids they're arrows. We don't like the idea of telling our kids they're olive shoots. But yet, both are really good metaphors, and they contain some good insight for us. So let's talk, first of all, about olive shoots. And then let's talk next about arrows. We'll make some application when we're done, and we'll point this all heavenward, okay? First of all, what does it mean when it says that our children are olive shoots around our table? For the olive shoot and the arrow, I want to give you the meaning and the action and the result. So if you're taking notes, just maybe have two columns. One that says olive shoots, one that says arrows. We're going to see what the meaning is, the action, and then the result in each one of those. First of all, what does it mean to be an olive shoot? Let's talk about olive trees for a bit, okay? Olive shoots. Here's probably the most important thing to know about how olive trees reproduce and how you get another olive tree, all right? An olive tree, if you cut it down, it will automatically, this may be true in a lot of horticultural aspects. I'm not a real smart guy on tree work and farming, but from just some research, this is enough to know that if you cut an olive tree down, whatever falls, it will produce suckers real close to the base of that tree that will grow pretty quickly. Do you know that? They'll sprout up. Apparently the soil around it could be pretty fertile, but those suckers will not be very fruitful. Now, the olive tree seems to grow best in California-type climate, the Middle East kind of climate. And most of the research shows that if you let an olive tree just kind of propagate, if that's even a good word, itself, and things that fall grow close to it, it'll grow quickly. It will look okay, but it really won't produce very many olives. And what's the point of an olive tree? To produce olives. And they usually go from green to blonde and to black. Here's the point we learn from this. Olive trees really are best, they produce best when they're taken off the mother tree, we'll call it, and they're planted a distance away. The soil is dug up, and they're either staked down into really soft, kind of fertile, muddy soil, or they're even laid totally in the ground. Maybe a branch or a part of the root is like a meter long, they say. And they'll take that and they'll dig it into the mud or the soil. In other words, they get it away from the mother tree, they get it somewhere, and they actually dig up the soil, they plant it. It's a very intentional process, saying, okay, now, here you are, you've got to grow. And that is a better way and a harder way to see the olive shoot really take root in its own territory and grow and then produce better olives. It'll still grow close to the mother tree, but it will always be kind of dependent and contingent upon that tree, and it really won't produce its own olives. So people come in there, and then here's the word you like, they kind of either take a tree and plant it, or they'll graft it into some other situation. But rarely do your best olive trees stay close to the one from which they came. So when the psalmist says, your children are like olive shoots, there's probably a sense in which he's saying, you know what, it takes some real intentional effort by the father and by the mother to say, okay, I'm going to take you where you're going to really multiply best. I'm not going to let you stay just close to here and be comfortable with us. You're around our table. We know we kind of you're shooting from this olive tree, but you're not going to multiply best until we intentionally take you somewhere and kind of plant you. Does that make sense? I mean, I think every Hebrew knew this when they read this. You're going to have olive shoots. You're going to have things that will multiply. And they thought, well, I just can't let them stay close. I can't let them just fall to the ground and stay close. They really won't do their job. I've got to take these little shoots, these little meter long, these yard long kind of things, and I've got to intentionally put them in some fertile soil, yes, to where they can then grow on their own and really multiply and be the right kind of olive tree. Here's the action we take. This slide talks about olive shoots, what it means. Here we go. The action we take is that we plant them. And here's the result, fruitfulness. Okay? Now, don't read into this. Don't think that we're saying that you must make your kids move away from home. There's something deeper here than geography. Are you with me? I think what's going on here is that we must remove, at a certain point, we remove a level of dependency that prevents our kids from really being fruitful the way God created them to be fruitful. You might even phrase it like this. They need to own their faith. You've heard that phrase before, right? And not just say, well, that's what my dad says. That's what my mom says. You know what that takes often? It takes an intentional parent who will say, you know what, I'm going to encourage you to go over here or study here or do this. This will be hard, but the soil is fertile and you'll grow immensely. And then we kind of back away in the right way and we let this young olive shoot kind of work through things. But when they grow, then they really produce the kind of fruit that would never have happened if they would have attached to us in a way that was probably dysfunctionally dependent. One of the stories that kind of describes this best is found in a book. It's fine print here, so let me read this to you. It's a book by Don Otis, and it's called Whisker Rubs. This is a good little story. Listen to this real quickly. How he pushed his son. He says, the son's writing here, at the end of my first year in college, my dad had the talk with me. Well, it wasn't the birds and the bees. He said, I had a job, I had a girlfriend, I was in school, I went to church. What else should a 19-year-old be doing? But my dad sensed the way men sense things about other men, that I was floundering. And you can begin to relate. You kind of seen this. An olive shoot's close to home, just enjoying the life of like ease and comfort. This is what we're supposed to be doing, right? He could have said, I did my best. It's time for Don to grow up on his own. But instead, my dad chose to step in. And we don't know all that he did when he stepped in, but here's part of the story. To this day, I can't tell you why I went. So his dad must have stepped in and said, I think there's somewhere you need to go. I think it was to this college in Switzerland that YWAM sponsors, a youth with a mission. Here's what he says. Perhaps it was divine providence, a son's obedience to his father, a sense of adventure, or a combination of all three. But the decision to attend Youth with a Missions School in Switzerland was made. I went and thoroughly hated it for the first 3 months. My room was little more than a closet. The teaching sessions were painfully long, and my girlfriend broke up with me. Then, when I was feeling as low as a man can, my spoiled middle-class attitude began to crumble. And the transformation has finally begun. I eventually returned home drastically changed. Back at college, my run-of-the-mill grades became A's and B's. My attitude toward others softened. My heart became more pliable. And it happened for one reason. My dad pushed me. Isn't that good? It was a dad who knew that if he let his son kind of hang near the tree in the wrong sense of the word, he might take root and grow, but he wouldn't really be fruitful. Guys, there is a real sense in this word olive tree that every Hebrew understood and that we've understood that fruitful olive trees, they're around our table, they start there, but at some point we have to take them and we've got to help plant them where they will be fruitful. What does Proverbs 22 say? You raise a child in the way that he is made. And there's ways to put that, according to his bent and those kind of things. What is the focus on? When we raise our kids, we focus on how God made them, where they're going to best kind of grow and multiply. It's not really about us. And so we've got to look at our children. We've got to say, how's God made them? How's God wired them? Where will they best fit? And then encourage them to get there. And that sometimes takes a lot of intentionality and a lot of willingness and a lot of humility to say, you know what? There's a whole big globe out there. Where do you want to go? How can I help you get there? Does that make sense? That's the point of olive shoots. We plant them. That's our action. And the result is fruitfulness. Now, I want to be frank with you. The word fruitfulness doesn't strike a male chord in me very much. It's kind of a women's word. Would you agree with that? Like, how do you tell a man to be fruitful? It's kind of weird. But I want to back up to Genesis 12 with you. What did God promise Abraham? That he would be fruitful. That his seed would be expansive. And what did that require? That Abraham leave where he was and go to a land that I will show you. You know that Abraham's from a family of idolaters? Did you know that? God came to Abraham and said, Abraham, I want to build a race through you through which the Messiah will come. And all the nations of the earth will be blessed through your fruitfulness. But to do that, I got to get you out of Dodge. I'm not going to tell you where that is yet, but I want to move you somewhere. So just pick up your stuff and follow me and I'll show you where. Isn't that interesting? The truth is, God did exactly to Abraham what we probably got to do to our kids. We've got to say, you know what? You're going to be most fruitful X place or wherever. We just got to help plant them to where they will really multiply, where they'll really bear fruit for God. This really is kind of a male term. It's got a good manly sense about it. Abraham embraced it totally. So see your kids first of all as olive shoots. And what that means for us as men is we have to intentionally know them, understand them, and then hopefully plant them in places and lead them to places where they can be most fruitful. The next metaphor, that is of an arrow. Look back at the previous chapter. Here he calls them arrows in the hand of a warrior. We love this one because it speaks of something a little more manly, doesn't it? The word here, arrow, is the word for spearhead. It's been used as a word for dart. In fact, at times it's been used to describe what an arrow would do when it lands in someone, like a wounding agent. So this is an arrow made for warfare. It's an arrow made for impact. And he says that children are a heritage. He says they're like arrows in the hand of a warrior. That's the children of one's youth. The idea is that we're launching them. So in an olive shoot metaphor, we plant them and we tend to them and we help them get in places that's fertile and yet they can grow. In the arrow metaphor, we are launching them. We're pulling back the bowstring. We're saying you need to go somewhere and create havoc in the enemy's camp. In fact, look what the remainder of verse 5 says, because there is some manuscript differences. ESV says, blessed is the man who fills his quiver with him. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. There are other manuscripts, though. They say that really it's a plural pronoun, they, and it speaks of actually the arrows the children, how they will not be put to shame when they speak with their enemies in the gate. And we'll let the scholars kind of decide if it's a he or a they. Here's the point. It could be a very good translation to say, you know, when you shoot that arrow and they land in the camp of the enemy, it wreaks havoc. It brings impact. And that's what our kids do. They go into the camps of the enemy, and because we've trained them and launched them well, when they get into the inside of the enemies, they're able to speak well and really represent Christ, because they've gotten that from the warrior, from the quiver. We've fashioned them well. We've launched them, and now they're doing what they're designed to do. You may think of the word forcefulness. So an olive shoot is planted for fruitfulness. An arrow is launched for forcefulness. Both are really good metaphors about how and what we're to do with our children. Olive shoots and arrows. Question. Are you planting and pushing your kids to where they are most impacting and most fruitful? Are you? Do you know your kids well enough to know where they would be planted best and where they would land best? What happens sometimes is I want to tread lightly here, is we tend to really want to keep our kids close, don't we? And I mean, I'm saying this to you as a guy that's probably wanting that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But there has to be a place in every family's life when you encourage your children to just look at the globe that God died for. Amen? For God so loved the whole world. And the world's getting smaller, it's flattening. And I think it's the wisest of parenting to be able to say to children, hey, listen, you got a whole earth to choose where you want to invest your life for God's kingdom. Take your pick and I'll support you. That's hard to say. And you're going to have, it's tough for your wife to hear that more than you. It's tough. But I think it's a good direction and route. And you know, a lot of times our kids stay close, praise God, but at least they've chosen then to say, here's where I can best be fruitful and multiply. Does that make sense? Are you tracking with me a little bit? I just think we have the courage to make sure that our children, our sons and daughters, see the vast array of opportunity that's before them for God's glory. I especially want to encourage you to have the courage to place before your children the need in unreached groups all across the globe. To go to places where maybe they would never be heard from like they would if they had some big church in America, or they had some big job at a bank or in some school system. I mean, those are all fine, but I'll tell you something. We need to strongly have our kids consider places where the gospel's never even been before, unreached and unengaged groups that need the gospel. And this younger generation needs to come face to face with, okay, could I be a part of bringing the gospel to an area that's never heard of Jesus before? And I don't know if that's going to happen unless parents sit down with their children at some point and say, hey, you know what? Here's how God seems to have gifted you. Here's how you're kind of wired. And would you consider taking your skills and talents to and then laying out a place far away and say, you know, I'll help you get there. I'll support you always I can. But you ought to think about going there. You may be the instrument God's using to bring the gospel to that place. That's a conversation I think every dad ought to have with their kids. Okay? That may kind of make you feel a little odd. But what does it mean to make disciples of all nations? What does it mean to have the gospel go to the ends of the earth? We've got to be willing to have a gospel-centered home to where we say, when I plant them, when I launch them, the whole globe is the target. Okay? Now, before I close, I want to give you a strategic way to plant and launch. Okay? Just a simple way that will help you. It involves strategic ceremonies. Here's how I kind of want you to write it down. I'll word it this way, then we'll wrap up with a simple story. I think strategic ceremonies heighten the target and tighten the bow. Better than most things throughout their 18 years, I think strategic ceremonies do these two things. They heighten the target and they tighten the bow. Now, this is not something that's new to us. There were several ceremonies in the life of Jesus. Do you recall his parents taking him to the temple when he was just a baby and dedicating him? And in the prophecies that were foretold, the songs that were sung? Do you recall his baptism? Pretty significant event in the life of Jesus before he entered into ministry at age 30. So this is not something that's just kind of humanly made. I think there are some strategic ceremonies along the life of Jesus. And the point is this. We tend to remember markers in our life, and then we tend to usually say, you know what, that's kind of what I'm after. That's kind of where I'm headed. Why do most girls want a big wedding ceremony? Okay, they want to be the center of attention, granted. But there's also a sense of a real ceremonial aspect to like this marker in life. When men were dubbed into knighthood and so forth, and you may have read the book Raising a Modern Day Knight by Robert Lewis. It's a good book about ceremonies and being strategic in raising boys. He talks a lot about how knights were brought along in certain aspects, and there were ceremonies that kind of were attached to certain moments. I want to encourage you. One of the best ways to plant and launch your kids effectively is to create strategic ceremonies at key moments in their life when you kind of paint this vision. Here's some samples or examples, okay? Some of them are older. I would encourage you to think of your own, all right? A lot of you remember the True Love Waits campaign. You remember the real push towards purity, which shouldn't stop, by the way. But it has fallen off the radar as far as that tag goes. But there was a sense in which men were to give their daughters a purity ring. You recall that. I'd encourage you to really keep that up. At a point when your daughter understands what purity is and why it's necessary, have some ceremony, some date, some kind of way to say, and give her some kind of symbol that she'll hold on to till the day that you give her away. It's something she will remember. And you can vary that. Some guys do it over dinner. Some guys do it with their wife. You think of your own way. Julie and I, we did this with Brianna. We went up to Hidden Acres. They have this little cabin that pastors can stay in. And so we had our 13th birthday party up there. And some of her friends came, had a big bonfire. But at a certain point in that, we kind of gave her this ring. And we inscribed it with a few things. And she was a little embarrassed in a way. And we knew that was coming because of our journey with Bethany. So we were a little wiser, not much, a little. But we gave her this ring. But later, she got back from a volleyball tournament. This is months later. And she was distraught when she came home. So I said, Brianna, what's the matter? She goes, oh, Dad, I lost my ring. Did you lose the game? I don't know. I lost my ring. She's like, I can't find the ring your mom gave me. And she did find it. We're glad. But that was the moment I realized, wow, she may have appeared to be embarrassed. It may have been a little awkward, but she was impacted by this event. And she wants to keep that ring. Does that make sense? Now, I want to back up and show you how this fits with session two. This will not happen accidentally. I remember the day Julie said to me, hey, I've got an idea for Brianna's ring. I was like, oh my goodness, I go shopping. That's what I thought. I love my kids. I love my wife. But the idea of shopping for a ring and looking at thousands of options and just a long conversation that would come from like, can't we just pick a ring, please? I mean, that's what I'm thinking as a man. I did not look forward to this process. But guess what? We had to do this. So it takes work. It's labor. That's what I'm saying, guys. This will not happen accidentally. And you must be willing to just engage some type of work. Like, okay, this is going to happen. I got to kick in. Your kids will remember ceremonies. And I'm glad Julie pushed me on that. She goes, you know, we got to get one. We need this much time to get engraved. I'm like, yeah, I know. And is there anyone who's ready-made? Can we just find one? I'm having all these terrible man thoughts, you know. It just takes work and planning. But man, I'm so glad we did it. With Brett, we played this game. We went to this farm, and he was 13. And you know Brett because you were his coach as a freshman. It was called the Manhood Mission Game. And I've got some video of it and some different things. I've taught our men about it. But basically all the dads of his best friends came together, and we were the enemies. And we were stopping Brett from becoming a man. And there were these keys around. There were four keys of what we taught Brett what it was to be a man, to reject passivity. And there's four of them. I should remember them. I don't have them off the top of my head. Sorry. But there were four keys. We hit them all over this farm, and we said, you got to find them. There were clues everywhere as well. And if we shot him so many times, or his friends, they were out of the game, had to wait so many minutes till they could, you know, be alive again. If he shot us, we were out for a longer amount of time, so they'd have time to find the clues and the keys. This took like 2 or 3 hours. And I told the dads, you know, we got to make sure that when all said and done, he does find the keys. And they're like, yeah, we get it, the point, you know. So it worked out good. We had a great paintball game. They shot us, we shot them. But realistically and honestly, he found the clues, and then they went to this little wooden place away from us. They figured the clues out, and we were waiting to kind of ambush him. They came out, and it was a great game. He found the box with the keys, and then at the end of that, had a ceremony, and had letters from both his granddads, and he read the letters, and he was awkward. He kind of felt weird, you know. Then we went out to eat, and of course, all guys love buffets, so we went to a buffet, and he and his friends are eating that up like crazy. I'm loving that as well, you know. When he got married, he took those keys, of course, and he put them in his room. And, you know, I didn't see him all the time. I don't know where all went. But when he got married, I said, hey, do you have those keys? And he said, yeah, what do you want with them? I'm like, can I just have the keys back for a few days? He goes, yeah, I reckon. So he knew where they were. He got them. And then at his wedding ceremony, I gave them to him. So I'm speaking at the wedding. I'm talking to him. I said, oh, by the way, son, there's something I want to give you that I think you've done well. And now you own these because your wife is depending on you to be a man. And I pulled the keys out and I gave him the keys. I said, here are the four things that you found when you were 13. And, of course, every eye in the audience from women, they're just crying, you know. But me and him are connecting on a level that was really important. Because he kind of sees this pattern. Okay, this kind of happened, and now here's this ceremony. My dad's giving his keys. It's my turn now. I know exactly what it means to be a man, and he's letting me go. I told him that day, I said, Brett, the bow's as tight as it can be today. I have only one thing left to do. I need to let go of the string. And I did. So we're crying, and Julie's just weeping. She goes, hold on to the string! Hold the string! She's the one to hold it, you know. I said, no, we need to let go. So he takes the keys, and we let go, and he's married now, and he's a happy man, you know, and he's got to work his way now through life. And he's living in Chicago, the best thing for his marriage. And I'm by no means these aren't all success stories. I mean, I've done a lot of dumb things, but the best thing for him is to live away from us for a year. I'll be frank with you, it is. He needs to be away from her parents and his parents and to wrestle through the first year of marriage together. And he's already called once. And I said to him, you know what? I think that's something you just got to figure out. I said, I'm not going to answer that question for you. Really? I said, you know what? You're smart enough to know the answer. And you know, you got a wife. And I think you guys can talk this through and figure it out. So I'll see you later. Bye. I hung up. Now, I'm no genius, but I'm just telling you guys, that's, I think ceremonies have helped our family a lot. We've done some things with Bethany as well. And we did a scavenger hunt at the mall when she was 13. All of our kids, right before they get their sixth grade year, they go on a trip with their dad or mom. Now, this is where it gets good for Julie because we have three girls and one boy. So me and Brett got to choose our trip, and we go. And if you're in the car, we call it the puberty trip. Because they're just about to hit puberty, which means everything changes for them and us. And they're going to start asking questions. You know, why is there hair in parts of my body that I don't know what's going on with this thing? Why am I having dreams? If you're a guy, what's going on, you know, down here? And I'm dreaming. Things are happening. Can you explain all this, Dad, to me? And girls start their period soon. So right before that happens, we take them on a trip. And we have this set of CDs from Dobson called Preparing for Adolescence. It's great. And it walks them through what to expect in puberty. It explains sex in a very cranial, kind of factual way. Then we talk about it. And we had this rule that when we're in the car, we have to listen to the CD. So you've got to go at least 8 hours away. Four there and four back. You can go to Kansas City, which is not quite eight, I know. But Kansas City, Minneapolis, Lincoln or something like that, or Chicago. And so most of our kids have always chosen Minneapolis. So we say when you're in the car, you have to listen to the CDs. The only person who can stop it is you. If you don't stop it, I'm not preaching. Your mom's not preaching. You just listen. If you stop it, you can talk, and I'll ask some questions. Otherwise, I'm not going to interrupt. It's just you and the CD and me. We'll talk. When we're out of the car, it's no puberty talk. It's all fun. So Brett said, we're going to Minneapolis, went to the Twins game, Spaghetti Factory. We had a great weekend at some hotel, went to the Mega Mall. But every time we're in the car, we listen to the CDs. And you know what's funny? Brooke is 12. She, just about 2 years ago, had her trip with Julie. Julie got three of these great trips. Lucky girl, you know. She got three of these trips. But just before Brooke went on, all three of the kids, I think Brett was home then, in fact. Either he was dating or engaged, but he said, Brooke, you're going to love it. And Bethany's like, Brooke, you better choose a mega mall. And then Brandon's like, yeah, and don't worry, the CDs don't last forever. I mean, they're just giving her all this wisdom, you know. And they're just, they remembered it. And they started telling her, like, Brooke, don't worry. The puberty canyon, it's not a big deal. You won't fall into it. Don't worry. And they're telling her all these stories. Julie said, wait, don't give away the CDs. Let her hear it. And it's hit me like, wow, they remember this stuff, you know. And here's what I'm saying, guys. Strategic ceremonies, trips, whatever you want to call them, they matter. And they help kind of plant the shoot or launch the arrow. It's just a practical way to put this into practice. Otherwise, if you don't intentionally set aside ways to take the little olive thing that falls, it'll stay close to home, and it'll sucker up, and it'll grow quick, and you'll love it, but it won't produce diddly. And if you don't put the arrow in the bow and you don't pull it back tight, it'll stay in the bow. Doop, you maybe dry. The enemy's not impacted. I mean, this verse is clear about where the arrow's supposed to go. So I want to encourage you in a gospel-centered way. Let's obey the word, but here's a practical way that I think helps us put it into practice. Now I'll close with this. This is exactly what God the Father did with Jesus. He planted him in an environment foreign and strange, in which he was considered an alien. Jesus let go of his right to be with God for these years, didn't he? Philippians 2. And he became a servant. In a real biblical way, God planted Jesus and he shot Jesus all the way to earth for our benefit, yes, but mostly for God's glory. Both are things that are in play. Aren't you glad that God... Now, I'm going to use this in a way that we can kind of get a hold of. Aren't you glad that God didn't say, well, you know what? We'll just keep Jesus close to home. But instead, he planted him as a servant. He shot him like an arrow right into the camp of the enemy, the camp of the religious Jewish Pharisees who mocked him and hated him and who eventually crucified him. But oh, the good that has come, the eternal glory that has come from the planting of Jesus in our society and the shooting of Jesus, so to speak. Our eternal good, God's eternal glory for all who believe. Wow. Jesus is our best example of someone who actually was planted in a difficult territory, was shot into the enemy's camp. And don't we love what happened because of that? What could happen if you let your kids and if you and your kids model that same thing that God the Father and Jesus have shown us? It takes intentionality. It's not by accident. It takes hard work. And there will be times when even your best laid plans, the response won't be perfect. I see Ryan over here. Is it Ryan? Yeah, he reminded me last night of a story that it's similar to this idea of just staying true to God, even if perhaps things don't work out well. I mean, our son played basketball for Ryan. He's a freshman. He played all through Ankeny High School. He was voted captain as a senior at Ankeny High School of their basketball team. That's a real honor. It's a big school, but he never played. And Jerry remembers this story because when it happened in 09, I was like, oh, brother. We were kind of looking forward to watching him play, and he really had a good testimony. But there were some freshmen that came up that year, and they were better. And they were at least equal, and they probably were better. But we were ticked as parents. We're like, what's the deal with that, you know? He came up and said, Daddy, he said, I'm not going to play this year much at all. I'm like, what? He said, you know what? They're going to really put their efforts toward the freshmen. They want to be good later. And then he said, you know what, Dad? He said, that's probably the right thing to do. He said, in Ankeny, you don't play just because you're a senior. You play if you're good. And he said, these guys are probably as good as me. And he said, I'm a little short. He said, I just need to know. He said, they voted me captain. I'll go to the center court every game. I'll represent our team. But he said, I'll come back and sit the bench most of the season. And you know what he did? It's exactly what happened. Coach Pete never really changed his mind. It's his call. He's the coach. And we told our kids, he's the coach. You got to live with it but you're not only criticizing. He's the coach. And he makes the call. And you know what? He sat that bench the whole year. And when he was done, he had a ton of respect. He didn't quit. He didn't say, well, hey, this didn't work out. I didn't get in my way. He kept his word. I mean, just those kind of things speak to me. And I just want to encourage you. You may not get the best response sometimes. But God will be glorified. Jesus will be pleased. And we're being faithful to Him, aren't we? That's our ultimate goal, to be faithful to Jesus, to the path He's laid out for us, to the example He set. And this is the example that God and Jesus set for us, to plant them and to launch them. Those seven ways earlier are some good ways to do that. Ceremonies are a good way to do it. And if you'll embrace that, if you will initiate that, then you'll be the man this chapter talks about. And your wife will flourish. And I can't even go into that message or even some other ones about the city aspect. But when your wife sees you embracing the role of being the man in your home, the individually owned leadership that has family-wide blessing, it has an amazing impact. And I just want to encourage you to model what God the Father and Jesus have done for us as they pointed us toward home. As Peter said, as they have returned us to the shepherd of our souls. Don't you love that word return there? It's like, where do we come from? Well, you didn't come from God in the sense that you're His children. You are His children by creation. He made you. But Peter uses that word to show, you know what? That's where we really belong. We belong with God. He made us. He owns us. And so Christ came to return us. I love that word. Man. So Christ came and He said, go home. Return home. I'm the way. He modeled this whole principle here. Everything about the right kind of home is wrapped up in seeing how Jesus and God relate, how they operated. That's our model. Can we leave this retreat with a gospel-centered view of how God the Father and God the Son operate together and effectively redeem the world? And then say to our families, you know what? I want to make sure that you have a proper way to look home. I want to lead you to worship God. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to plant you. I'm going to launch you. I'm going to re-engage with you. Model Jesus, model God the Father. Man, our homes would see a substantial difference, wouldn't they? That's the kind of man God's calling for. And I hope you don't leave here feeling guilty or beat up. I hope you leave here at least looking in the mirror and say, you know what, God? Man, help me to live in a Trinitarian way for Your glory in the home You've given me. Whether it's you and your wife only or you and your grandkids. You matter, men. You matter. Can I pray with you as we close? Lord, we just talked about a number of things from this chapter, how to be the man that has the kind of rippling effect that is talked about in this chapter. Who's deep down happy, and then that begins to affect those around him. It's kind of swinging for the fence with those who are closest to us. We talked in these last two sessions about some practical ways to do that with our children, with our wife. Lord, but it all comes down to this motivation that we get from You. As we look at how You and Jesus really went to bat for us. And I don't know where all you men are in relation to your relationship with Jesus. But you can go home and be a good man. You can be a world's perfect husband, world's perfect dad. But you know, as good as that is on this earth, that's not what gets you to heaven. And God doesn't give any like kudos one day at the judgment because you were a good dad or a good husband. He just doesn't. He only sees us as worthy through His Son Jesus. I'd hate for you to come up here and learn about how to be a good dad and miss why it's all possible. It's only possible because God the Father sent Jesus the Son into a hostile enemy kind of territory. He planted Him and He launched Him. And then together they, as one, yet with these different roles, they redeemed mankind through the death of Jesus. And that's the only way to stay motivated long term. Because when your parenting doesn't work every time, or when your husbanding doesn't work every time, without Jesus and God the Father as our prime motivation, we quit. We just bail. We're like, well, I'm done. It didn't work. But you see, God's got to be more than a tool. God's got to be a treasure. that we love and cling to, even when things aren't going so well. Even when folks respond with choices that aren't what we desire or really anticipated. And there's some men here I know who could help lead you to Jesus. And if you've never trusted Christ, if you've never prayed to receive and take your stand on the gospel, I want to encourage you. I just want to ask you to repent of your sin, of depending on yourself, and turn and trust Jesus, whom God sent in the world to be the Savior of mankind. You might say something like this: Dear God, I know that I'm lost. I know that I will never be good enough, and I'm thankful that I don't have to be good enough. All I have to be is, I have to believe in Jesus, who He was and what He did. So God, this very moment, I believe in Jesus, who He was and what He did. He died and He was buried and rose again. That's the gospel. And I take my stand upon the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus as the only way to be saved and made right with You. So God, save me through Jesus today. God the Father, because of God the Son, will do exactly that. He will save you and make you His child. You'll find in that the deepest motivation to continue being the man in your home, even when perhaps not everything works out perfectly. You'll find that that is the beginning of God becoming a treasure, not a tool. Lord, keep doing Your amazing work at these churches. Sailorville, Lakeside, Living Waters. Lord, continue to raise up church planters. Continue to raise up men who will lead first and foremost in their homes for Your glory. And I thank You, Lord, for the inspiration I've received just by rubbing shoulders for a few hours here with these men. Thank You for their challenges. Thank You for their good questions. Thank You for their receptivity. And may we leave now and we head back into arenas where You've placed us. Lord, may we put some things into practice, not just to be better, but to bring Your glory to the small arena in which we live. May we lead our families in this ascent to worship You and to know You. As in the name of our Redeemer, Jesus, we pray. Amen.